Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm delighted to have you all with me today. Today we're going to talk about a very important topic that a lot of us can relate to, and that is the increase in the poundage that most of us are carrying around, a very high percentage of obesity, nasty word, but being overweight in this country has become much more the norm than the exception in the last 20, 30 years, and it's really getting to crisis proportions, and we do need to think about how we're going to stop this train and turn it around. So I wanted to remind you first that this program is brought to you each week by the VHL Family Alliance. We are an organization for people with von Hippel-Lindau disease, but this program is intended for people with many different medical conditions, and particularly for those people who are living with a complex medical condition, and that means that you're dealing with more than one medical specialist. So if you have a complex medical condition or a disability, that's the primary target audience for this program. And, of course, shows like this one are of interest to an even broader group of people. Let me play you a little bit of information about our sponsor, about VHL, and then we'll be right back to talk with our very special guest for today. Thank you.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Thank you, and we hope you'll check out vhl.org, and of course also go to powerfulpatient.org, which is the home website for this show, where you'll find all the shows that we've done in the last 3 years, 3 years and more, and lots of interesting topics for you to explore. So today we're talking about obesity in America, and I'd like to welcome our guest. It's James Zervius, Director of Communications for the Obesity Action Coalition. Welcome, James.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me today.
Sure. It's our pleasure. So tell us what the Obesity Action Coalition is.
Sure. The OAC is a national 501c3 registered nonprofit. We were founded more than 5 years ago. And basically, we exist to serve individuals affected by obesity, morbid obesity, and childhood obesity through education, advocacy, and support.
So this, as we said before, is a growing problem, alarmingly growing problem. And, you know, it's seen by the rest of the world as a problem of America's affluence. You know, they have too much money, they have too much food, and they get fat and one thing and another. But one of the things I've observed is that it's often even more prevalent amongst poor people. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think that there's definitely a relationship between excess weight and socioeconomic status. You know, by and large, obesity disproportionately affects the African-American community as well as the Hispanic community. And this can be attributed to many factors, anything from education regarding nutrition to the availability of nutritious foods such as fresh fruits and vegetables. So I think when you kind of combine all these things, it definitely disproportionately affects one population versus the other.
Right, so it's not just about eating too much food, it's also about eating the wrong foods. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a safe statement. It's eating the right foods. It's not eating the wrong foods. And it's also knowing what are the right foods, what are the wrong foods. Just because something says healthy for you on the box doesn't necessarily mean that it is, in fact, healthy.
Right, right, exactly. And so if you're going to the grocery store with your food stamps or whatever, the first thing is what's available. And in a lot of inner city grocery stores, there frequently is not much in the way of fresh fruits and vegetables to choose amongst, right?
Yes, I mean, that is correct.
And I know some cities are really working at that, but nonetheless, that's part of the problem. And I know from my own experience, when you're busy at work, whatever amount of money you make, and you have to stay late, then I remember many times hovering around the vending machine saying, what in here might remotely be construed as lunch?
It's usually
too much sugar or too much salt or both.
There's a lot of contributing factors that go into excess weight. I mean, and you know, our work schedules, our life schedules, technology, anything, you know, all those can be factors. It's learning how to manage all of them and realizing, you know, how your weight affects your health that's the most important.
Right. And the other thing is that, you know, as you mentioned on the website, we're all being bombarded with messages, marketing messages from people who would like to sell us processed foods of one kind or another. And it's often the wrong stuff, you know, the double wide hamburgers and the sugared cereals and things like that that really are not contributing to our nutrition, even though they do put the word healthy on the box.
Yep, that is true. That's very, very true.
So how do we change this? I mean, for example, here's one example, high fructose corn syrup. And I don't know, you want to speak to that? I mean, there's research from the NIH that shows that obesity took off big time when they raised the amount of high fructose corn syrup that could be put into various products. You know, I've seen the graph. It's just dramatic. And yet now there's this campaign to rename it, to give us all this disinformation about, it's just sugar in another form. Your body can't tell the difference. But in fact, our bodies can tell the difference.
Well, I think it's like anything else that's out there, whether it's high fructose corn syrup, ice cream, whatever is out there in front of you. If you're not making the right decision when choosing what you're going to put into your body, you're not going to be leading a healthy life, and your quality of health will suffer. You know, the corn syrup debate, we've had a couple articles on it. I am not a medical professional, so I cannot speak to the way it affects your body. But just like anything else, there are foods that you can eat out there. If you change what you eat, you know, maybe you won't be eating something with an enormous amount of high fructose corn syrup in it. I mean, if you look at sodas, which have a very large amount of sugar, you know, it's not a necessity to drink soda. You don't need soda to live. You do need vitamins, you need minerals, but you don't need soda. So,
right.
You know, those things, cutting certain things out of your diet and reducing them, reducing your caloric intake, definitely can help with increasing your health. To speak directly to high fructose corn syrup, you know, unfortunately, I'm not a medical professional, so I really can't comment on that topic. I've seen the studies, I've seen the charts. There's no doubt that you definitely see somewhat of an increase. There is an increase, you know, once that was introduced into society or the levels were, you know, increased. But again, you know, it's just because it's out there doesn't mean necessarily that you have to put it into your body.
Right. And so, as you say, a lot of it is learning what choices we ought to be making and making the right decisions about it. But sometimes we get fooled because, you know, we think we're having that healthy replacement lunch bar or something like that. And in fact, the marketing messages are not consistent with reality. And seeing through that fog is sometimes very, very difficult.
Well, I think one of the most important things that someone can do is to educate themselves on how to read a nutrition label. Nutrition labels are on the back of almost every single thing that you put into your body. And to look at on the back of it, look at the ingredients, look at the nutrition label. How many calories does it have? How many grams of sugar does it have? How much sodium does it have? How much fat does it have? What kind of fat does it have? you know, to educate ourselves and to look at those things a little bit more often, I think can really help you make smart food choices. And that's not only when, you know, grabbing something. I understand if it's in a vending machine, maybe you physically can't take it out. But even if you make an educated guess through the glass, you know, you get what you get, look at it, keep the wrapper, and the next time choose something else and say, okay, which was better, which was healthier for me? I mean, off the top of my head, I can't tell you if a Pop-Tart is healthier than a, you know, Snickers bar. I have no idea.
Right.
I would have to look at the both of them. But, you know, there's no harm in educating ourselves a little bit about that.
Right, right. And sometimes, you know, we all are going to choose something that we know really is not the greatest choice, but it may be the best of the various alternatives. But for the most part, from the research that I've been doing for my own self, because I'm in this pudding too, is the closer we get to the farm, the more likely that this food is good for you as opposed to not so good for you. So if it's, you know, real fruits, real vegetables, things like that are almost always good choices, but the processed foods are the ones that can get you into trouble and can be sneaking things in the back door that you wouldn't put in if you were making this at home. Too much fat, too much salt, too much sugar, because it makes it taste better, so we think it's wonderful. But if you, as you say, if you read the label, you realize you're really putting too much fat, too much salt, too much sugar into your body. And that, plus the teaspoon of sugar you put in your coffee, is all of a sudden too much.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think the other thing I've observed as I try to do that is that all those labor-saving packaged things don't save you much more than about 10 minutes in the kitchen. You know, it's really not all that much more difficult to make some rice and throw in some vegetables and some beans. And it's, in fact, a great deal cheaper.
Oh, yeah. You're paying for it to be combined before you cook it. I mean, you're paying for their effort to make it packaged for you. So there's no doubt that you would save some money doing it on your own. You're probably going to make it healthier. You could, you know, modify it to what you're looking for. If you like more carrots, put more carrots in. You like more, you know, water chestnuts, put more water chestnuts in. So I really think, you know, that learning how to prepare your food and what to eat is very, very important in maintaining your health.
My mother was talking with a woman who doesn't have very much money, and they were talking about black beans. And the woman said, yeah, I had to go get a can of black beans. My mother said, wait a minute, why'd you buy the can? She said, well, that's how you buy them. And my mother said, if you buy them dry and soak them overnight, they cost you like 10% of what you paid for the can.
Mm-hmm.
So things like that that we've lost sight of, that used to be the normal way things were made, but now we've gotten so used to packaged foods that a lot of us have forgotten some of the less expensive ways to make actually more nutritious food.
Absolutely.
And tell us, there are states, I saw the information on your website about Georgia, and Georgia has a campaign to try to reduce obesity, and the reason that they have undertaken this as a state is because they are the state with the second highest rate of childhood obesity in the country. Is that right? And who's number one?
It's probably Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not 100% sure, but it's probably Mississippi. Usually Mississippi, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, you always find those somewhere in the top five or six.
Okay, and then I would assume that major contributing factors are things like frying foods and sweet iced tea, I've been told, is one of the big offenders, and canned sodas.
I mean, I think all those things contribute to it. I'm sure there's definitely other factors. There's environmental factors involved, and there's physical activity. So, you know, as far as from a nutrition standpoint, that southern cooking has always kind of received a little bit of a bad reputation in contributing to the obesity epidemic.
Well, it used to be when you worked out in the fields that you needed some extra fat in order, you know, fat in your diet, not that it got packed on your hips at all, But to give you the strength and the stamina that you needed to make it through an 8 or 10-hour day in the fields. But now that we're not all working in the fields anymore, we really need all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, unless somebody's, you know, still working on a farm somewhere, I'd say by and large most individuals in all of those states probably have, you know, typical jobs that you would find in America today, office jobs, you know, working in retail, so on and so forth, not so much of labor-intensive jobs.
Right, and driving a truck rather than wrestling logs with a mule and a tractor.
Yeah.
Right, so, I mean, almost all of us are much less physical these days than we were 50 or 100 years ago. Well, the other thing I've noticed, especially around children, is when I was a kid, and this was, you know, before there was that much programming on television, in the 1950s, we were always outside. And it was before air conditioning was very prevalent. And even in the very hot weather, we were outside playing and running up and down and chasing balls and sticks and things like that. These days, the kids are at home with the electronic toys.
Well, you know, I think, we definitely should pay respect to technology and the advancements it's made. I mean, without technology, you would not have some of the medical advancements that we've had in the past 50 years. But, you know, there is something to be said about the electronic toys at home, the video games, so on and so forth. And it's everything needs to be in moderation. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with a video game, but should a child sit in front of a television for 5-6 hours a night and play? Probably not. You know, I would leave that up to their parents to manage that and make sure that they're still getting in an adequate amount of physical activity.
Right, but so much of our physical activity now is sort of scheduled. You know, the soccer practice and those kinds of things, which becomes a task for the parent rather than the kids are outside playing ball. So, you know, and I'm certainly not downing technology, but just sort of noticing some of the changes in our own habits, and mine as well. And as you say, when we sit in front of a computer all day, it's a lot different than the way we used to conduct our business, which was much more conversation and physical activity even within the office than it is today. So, okay, so we have these changes. They've happened to us. What are we able to do about it? And I don't know if George is a good case study or if you want to use a different one to talk about what the public realm is doing, things like the state effort that's going on in Georgia, and what's and what's bad about those efforts.
Let me just be clear with the effort in Georgia. While we support raising awareness of childhood obesity, we absolutely do not support that campaign. Campaign, the imagery and the content that is used is incredibly stigmatizing toward children. And we've actually requested an immediate retraction of that campaign based on that alliance in the state of Georgia.
Right, I saw that. So tell me more about what you find difficult about that campaign.
Well, some of the imagery, the video that's used, the text that is printed on the campaign, and then also the verbal text in some of the videos, it's stigmatizing toward children. All I think it does is just kind of feeds that bullying machine that is not a good thing for a child affected by obesity. And that is something we would like to see that campaign completely revamped. And we're more than willing to sit down with that alliance and help them develop a more appropriate campaign.
Well, give us an example. I mean, for example, in one video, there's a little girl saying, you know, I feel badly because the other people are making fun of me. So what would be a better way to approach that? I mean, that may be part of the reality, but that's not very constructive. It just reinforces the bad part of what's going on.
Well, I think some of the ones, I think there was one in there that references something like, people say I have my dad's eyes, but actually I have his diabetes. I think that's just it's mocking the diabetes in children. I don't feel that that's raising awareness of it. So I think that there's different instances without the campaign. We've surveyed our members, and more than 85% of them feel that the campaign is offensive and it's stigmatizing toward children. They feel it is not helping them. If anything, it's only encouraging bullying based on the statements and the imagery that are used throughout the campaign.
Right, because when people start feeling desperate about their weight, then they start doing stupid things to try to lose weight, and that's also not good for you.
Right, and if you're being teased and bullied constantly as a child, you may be taking drastic measures to lose your weight, such as eating disorders, anorexia, bulimia, you know, so on and so forth.
Right, and I saw one piece from somebody, I don't even know the name now, but it really angered me. They said, oh, yeah, we need to address this with bariatric surgery in children. And I'm going, whoa, baby, that sounds pretty drastic to put kids through surgeries. What is your stance on that?
Well, you know, the OAC believes that bariatric surgery is a valid treatment option for those who qualify. And when we say those, at this time we're talking specifically about adults that qualify for it. We have seen cases where children have undergone bariatric surgery and they've been very successful in losing weight. However, we need to make sure that we're exploring all options, especially in a child, before undergoing bariatric surgery, because it is a major surgery and it should not be taken lightly.
Right, there's risks of infection and many other things. But in addition to that, from the people that I know of who've had those kinds of surgeries, unless you really change your way of doing, it's not going to give you the long-term benefit that you were hoping for.
Well, and that's why it's so important, if you're considering bariatric surgery, that you really have it done at a center of excellence. Those programs are going to have the most comprehensive pre-op and post-op program, to where you're not really going to have any opportunity to slip, and they're going to help you by providing you with the tools needed so that you have a much, you know, healthier life as you move forward and that you're able to make these lifestyle and behavioral changes.
Well, and when the child is obese, it's, I would think, statistically fairly rare that it's one child in a family who's obese. I mean, there are instances of that, but more often, I think, it's a family affair, is it not?
Yeah, it is. I think that's a safe statement. Most of the times, if you come across a child that is affected by obesity, most of the time, at least one parent will also be affected by obesity or even morbid obesity. And I think that just kind of contributes to the whole makeup of the disease of obesity, whereas you could see it doesn't affect just one person, it's affecting everyone in the household. And now, of course, I mean, you know, again, I'm not a medical professional. You want to get down to the genetic makeup of someone, their DNA. You know, someone can be in a house with individuals affected by obesity and not have any excess weight at all because of just the way their body is made up. So,
right.
But by and large, you know, if one person in the family is overweight, then usually there will be more than that person, the parents, the children, so on and so forth.
Right, because often it's a problem of, as we were talking about before, the cooking pot. It's all, we're all eating out of the same cooking pot, and if it's got the wrong ingredients in it, then more than one person in this household has probably got too much weight on. Okay, so nutrition is one element, and there's an emotional side to eating. And certainly if you're being bullied in school, one of the possible ways of dealing with that is eating more, is comfort food.
Absolutely. You know, that tends to happen when someone is bullied. Even as an adult, it can drive them to just consume more food, just to comfort themselves.
Mm-hmm. So if, for example, if the mother has been a yo-yo dieter her whole life and may be perfectly thin, and sees her child getting to be overweight, sometimes the mother panics and begins to put a lot of pressures on the kid, which can backfire.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been scientific studies done that show that that type of pressure, that type of bullying, will actually increase an individual's weight rather than decrease it.
Tell us a little bit about yo-yo dieting, because that it's an expression for people who gain 5 pounds, lose 5 pounds, gain 5 pounds, lose 5 pounds, gain 10 pounds, lose 5 pounds. And
well,
eventually you kind of ratchet up, right?
Again, you know, I just want to preface, I'm not a medical professional. I'm not a dietitian. So, you know, yo-yo dieting, from what I understand and from individuals that I've worked with, you know, it's one of those things where you have to be ready to make that lifestyle change. And if you're not ready and you find yourself slipping and you're doing it on your own, it's not easy to always overcome any obstacle. And I think that's sometimes why you see someone lose 10 pounds and then put 10 pounds back on, because it's very difficult to stay dedicated to those lifestyle changes and those behavioral changes, especially if you're in a marriage and the other person is not willing to make that change, those foods are still in the house. That's not easy. You're constantly being tempted. You know, it's a very big hurdle to overcome. So I think sometimes that's why you see that back and forth a little bit.
Right, right. And the other thing is that I think many Americans reach for that quick fix diet. You know, they're all over in every magazine. There's the she lost 10 pounds in 2 weeks or something like that. And those quick fix diets are the ones that almost always result in gaining back that weight.
Yeah, because there's no such thing as a diet. It needs to be a lifestyle and behavioral change. I mean, I will use myself as an example, which I don't do that often, but about a year ago, I was diagnosed pre-hypertensive. My doctor wanted to put me on high blood pressure medication. I weighed about 225 pounds, and I'm about 5'9.5". And I realized at that moment that I needed to make a lifestyle change. So a year later, I lost about 63 pounds, and I'm down to 162, 163. I fluctuate here and there a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm no longer hypertensive, no high blood pressure, nothing. But I had to be ready to make that change. I could not have done it on a diet. I did not do a diet. When people say, how did you lose the weight? I did it through a lifestyle change, cut out certain foods, reduce the certain amount of foods, increase physical activity. So to me, a diet is a temporary thing. It's not a permanent thing. A lifestyle change is a permanent thing.
Right, right. I have a friend who was told he might be pre-diabetic, and he gave up soda pop, made no other changes, just gave up soda pop. And within 2 months, he had lost 16 pounds, and he was totally amazed. You know, what a huge difference it meant just giving up soda pop.
Absolutely. It's amazing what the small little lifestyle changes can do. And those changes can eventually lead into bigger changes with, you know, even bigger improvements.
Mm-hmm. Right. Tell us, what is body mass index? They're using this BMI term a lot. What is that? Why do we need to worry about it?
Well, you know, BMI is a very much just a benchmark estimate of your body mass index. And it's a calculation with all these fancy numbers between, you know, your height and your weight, and you come up with your BMI. BMI isn't always the best if you're dealing with someone that has a lot of muscle mass, although some studies have found out that, you know, weight on your heart is weight on your heart. Now, of course, if you're morbidly obese, you may be affected by some obesity-related conditions, such as diabetes, hypertension, so on and so forth. But even if you have muscle weight, it's still weight on your heart. So weight is weight. However, there are some implications with weight if it's more body fat than it is muscle. But back to BMI. Really, BMI is more or less just a marker to see where you fall at in the BMI scale. It's something that's, you know, done by the CDC. They put it out, and we do promote BMI. And it's not meant to be, you know, it's scientific in that it's going to tell you every single thing about your body. It's just meant to tell you where do you fall. A year ago, when I did my BMI, I was very, very, very surprised that I was in the obese range. I really could not believe that. I was pretty shocked that I had actually become obese. Today, if I do my BMI, I'm in the normal weight category. So I think it's just really, it's a very general measurement of body mass. It's really important if you do your BMI that you talk to your doctor about your BMI and see how is it affecting you if you feel that you're not in the range you should be.
So it's a way of making objective, how chunky are you?
Well,
is that more or less it?
I don't know if I would say that, because I think that might not be a fair representation because of individuals' heights and their weight. So it's not, you know, someone who's very short their BMI, they're limited by their height. So, that, you know, 10 pounds on them could be like 20 pounds on someone who's taller. So you really have to, I think it's more or less just a benchmark for people to figure out where they fall in the weight status categories.
Right. So just looking at weight doesn't tell the whole story. Weight and height together tell a much better story of whether this amount of weight is appropriate for that height or not. Is that more or less right?
I think so. I think it's more or less just it's just giving you a real rudimentary scale based on your height and your weight. This is where you fall in the weight status categories, again, developed by the government. This is where you may fall. You know, if you do it and it comes back obese, well, that might be something that you want to speak to your doctor about and just say, hey, look, you know, I did my BMI saying I'm obese. You know, can we do a blood panel? Can we see if I'm, you know, my diabetes, do I have diabetes? What's my sugar level? You take my blood pressure. It's really just something to kind of open up that conversation with a healthcare professional.
Right. And you have a little calculator on your website, right? It's www.obesityaction.org. And there is a BMI calculator there if you're curious what yours is. But basically it's putting us in, giving us information that we are either within that normal range or thinner than the normal range or above it, which would be called obese, or a lot above it, dangerously above it, which is called morbidly obese. And so the morbid part is to tell you, you know, this is truly affecting your health.
Yes.
Okay, and so it's not necessarily as morbid as the word morbid often sounds, but at least to say, hey, you know, caution lights are definitely flashing here, and you really ought to put some attention on, as you say, a lifestyle change, not a quick fix, but a lifestyle change that's going to really help with your long-term health, with your hypertension, your high blood pressure, or potentially with sugar issues. And just having that additional weight on your frame and your heart is also not great.
Absolutely.
Now, we started talking before about what are some of the better ways to address this problem. Is there some state program or any program, it doesn't have to be a state program, that you find constructive?
To address weight issues?
Yes, to try to address the problem of obesity in America.
In each state, you know, your state has your state vocational and rehabilitation programs. And we actually have a section on our website underneath our advocacy section, it could be advocacy tools, where you can go in and look at your state map, and you click on your state, and you can contact the state and vocational rehabilitation center to see if they are offering any programs to help you lose weight. Sometimes there's even free programs at your YMCA. You know, you can even go to a local gym, see if they're doing anything as a promotion to get you back on track. But most importantly of all, before you start any of that, you need to speak to your healthcare professional to make sure that you're able to take part in those programs and that that is something that's right for you.
Right, because even though we're feeling okay, it could be that there's some risk factors that are not real obvious to us that the doctor needs to coach us through or tell us, you know, how much activity is okay and how much activity is too much at this point. And then as you lose weight, you may be able to change that program, but you need to start gently and not overdo it.
Yes.
Right, one of the most discouraging things is to say, okay, I'm going to do this no matter what, and you go to the gym 5 times a week, and then within 2 weeks you can scarcely move, and that's obviously not real constructive. So if you have the opportunity to work first with, certainly with your doctor first, and second with a personal trainer to get you started on the right foot, and with a gentle program and then build on it, that is a much better way to do it.
Absolutely.
So we've seen the rate of obesity triple since 1980. Wow. The stats just for Georgia were in 1982, 4% of children were considered to be obese. Today, more than 30% 5% of children are considered obese in the state of Georgia. And the numbers are similar around the country, right? Or they vary some, but not enormously in most states, right?
Yes, I mean, you know, by and large, you know, each state, I think maybe there's two or three that haven't, but most of them have seen an increase in obesity in their state, definitely since the 80s.
Right, and the major factors we're talking about are nutrition and activity. The other major shift in America is that in the 1950s, most people ate most meals at home and carried their lunch. Today, almost half of the money spent on food is spent outside the home, in restaurant eating and so forth.
Yes, but again, I mean, you can eat at a restaurant and make a healthy choice. So it is possible to make a healthy choice. Many restaurants, if you ask, will provide you the items on their menu with the nutritional content. They will provide you with some type of a food label. So, the menu labeling is something that's been discussed for a very long time now, and it probably would really impact a lot for those that are interested in what they choose when they eat out.
Right, so knowing what's in it, and we can read food labels in the grocery store, but we can't always read food labels in the restaurant. I know a lot of the fast food restaurants, McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's, now they have that information available at least on their websites, and it's pretty stunning when you read it. You thought that fish sandwich had less fat in it? Wrong. So do check out those food labels, and then your average restaurant doesn't tell you. So there are a couple of challenges with restaurants. One is what's in it. The other one, of course, is how much is on that plate. And a lot of restaurants put a lot of food on a plate to make you feel better about paying the bill, when in fact it's really enough for two or three meals.
Oh, absolutely. Food portion size, that's always an interesting thing. I've seen many presentations by a variety of dietitians that do presentations on food portion, and you'd be amazed at what is a portion size for a piece of meat or for pasta. You know, by and large, restaurants probably serve 3-4 times what a normal portion size should be.
Right, and that's unique to the U.S., by the way. So if you travel outside the U.S. and you order a dinner out, you'll be surprised how much less food there is on the plate. But as you say, the portion size for a piece of meat is like a deck of cards or like the palm of your hand. And you can imagine in a restaurant you're getting 3-4 times that. So, you know, be prepared to take home a doggy bag, and don't be shy to do that because it could well be tomorrow's lunch. Okay, what other things would you like to bring up to help our audience understand what is a good program and what is a not so good program? I still haven't really heard much about that.
Well, I think for are you talking about a weight loss program?
Well, no, I was thinking of, you know, we've got a public health problem on our hands now. It's not just a few folks when you can handle it in the doctor's office. It's rampant in the United States. But as we've said before, bullying and shaming and things like that don't work. They totally backfire. We learned a lot of those things from the smoking cessation programs. I remember at one point the UK had pictures of gunked up lungs in the post office, you know, to really get the point home that this is very bad for you. And it made people want to smoke more. So, you know, and we have a similar problem with eating. You know, if you get people nervous, more people will eat more than will eat less. So, how do we really help? We've got some nutrition programs. Are they going into the schools? Are they getting to the people who really need the nutrition programs? We have health clubs, but they cost money. Or they aren't terribly convenient. And I remember one time I called my insurance company because I saw that another competing insurance company would give you a break on a health club, and I called my insurance company and said, you know, what reimbursement is there? And the woman laughed. She simply laughed. She said, health club, are you kidding? So,
well, so I think because obesity is so individual to each person that, I'm sorry, so specific to each individual that it affects, you really have to find what's right for you. You know, a gym membership can cost upwards of $30, $40 a month. Now, if that's beyond your means, you know, go buy a pair of tennis shoes, go for a walk, start with walking, then move to jogging, then go for a run. You know, eating healthy, it's not cheap to eat healthy. It is expensive to buy healthy food. But what other areas in your life could you scale back on to be able to purchase healthier food? I mean, let's not forget, this is your health. And this is your health. So if, you know, going out on a Friday or Saturday night and doing that favorite thing you love to do is more important than your health, well, that's a decision that you have to make. You know,
I would wager that if you bought healthy food at the grocery store instead of packaged food, that your bill would actually be less. I mean, if you look at organic blueberries versus conventionally grown blueberries, yes, the organic ones are more expensive. But real food versus packaged food is actually cheaper.
You'd be surprised. I encourage you to shop once healthy and shop once with more processed foods, and you will absolutely find that you will spend more money on the healthy foods than you will on the processed foods. And it's been proven. It's not cheap to eat healthy. It costs money to eat healthy. I'm not talking so much about, you know, the fruits and vegetables over there. I mean, you pay by the pound, you pay by the ounce. But by and large, if you try to buy healthy foods, a lot of grocery stores have the organic sections now, and look at what a box of cereal costs in an organic section versus in the regular section, and you will see a significant price increase in the organic section. So,
I absolutely agree with you with what you just said about the organic section versus the conventional section. But if, for example, you buy rice and beans and put them together yourself, you will pay a great deal less than you will with a box of rice and beans combined. So I mean, that's the kind of choices I'm talking about. And not even before we talk organic, there are many things that you can do to get closer to the farm and reduce the amount of money that you're paying to some manufacturer to put it together for you. And so, you know, it all depends on the choices that you make. So whatever appeals to your family, it's going to be a different grocery list. So do it that way. But, yes, it's more expensive in the organic department. But if you buy a box of cereal in either place, you're paying a lot more than you would for a box of oatmeal.
I don't want to get into a food debate because I think that, again, we're getting into a very specific avenue for individuals. And this leads me to what I started saying is that, you know, obesity affects each person very specific, and that for someone they may respond to physical activity immediately. Someone may respond to simply changing their diet immediately. So in order to find that best program that fits you, you have to figure out what is it that you are going to be able to do to increase your health. So if you like being outdoors, do you take up bike riding? Do you take up rollerblading? What will you do? What lifestyle changes can you do to make a difference? And really talking to your healthcare professional is the best way to start that and the best way to identify how to make some of those simple changes.
So the focus of your programs is on the individual, which is correct, of course. It's where each of us needs to do it. But what I'm concerned about is the public health programs here. And as we've talked about, because I don't have that perspective. I was hoping you did. Many of the public health programs, like the one that you're fighting in Georgia, are demeaning, stigmatizing, reinforce the downing of people who carry too much weight rather than really trying to help that family see that there is something in it for them
to undertake this. we've gotten caught up with the messaging, and there's very much a so what factor in a lot of the programs that you see developed. The Georgia program, you're raising awareness of childhood obesity. Okay, we know there's a childhood obesity epidemic. We know that 1 in 3 children are affected by childhood obesity. We know that today's children, some of today's children, will not outlive their parents. We know that for the first time ever, children are being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes because of their weight. We know these things. So there's a so what factor. You're telling us that children in Georgia are affected by obesity. Okay, so what?
So what, exactly. So is there an effort to get advertisers not to push sugared cereals on our children in the children's programming on television? You know, what kind of constructive action is being taken?
Well, I think you just spoke of one of them. I mean, there's always been some talk around advertising, especially during the Saturday morning cartoons. Why did they have to have, you know, so many marketing commercials toward children regarding food, rewarding children with food? The thing is, though, no matter what program is developed and however anyone goes about it, if it's not being implemented in the home, it falls on deaf ears.
So no, absolutely. But we took action as a society about alcohol. We disallowed the drinking of alcohol by people on television. We did this for smoking. So is it time to do it for processed foods and sugar?
Well, see,
is it time to tell the people who are lying to the American people about high fructose corn syrup that they cannot do that?
If you look at the cause and effect, okay, if you look at alcohol and alcoholism, and if you look at cigarettes and lung cancer, right? I mean, those were the big pushes why those two things were removed the way they were. If you look at those two things, both of them, alcoholism and lung cancer, are viewed as a disease by the American public. Obesity is not viewed as a disease. Irregardless of what we think as a coalition, it's not viewed. And it's also the last acceptable form of discrimination. We would never make fun of someone that has an alcoholism problem. We would never make fun of someone that is affected by cancer. We would never make fun of someone that's affected by type 2 diabetes. But yet we're okay with stigmatizing an individual affected by obesity. We're okay with mocking them in modern media and in film. We're okay with that. And that is the reason why you have not seen the push that there needs to be across the board, from adult to childhood, to really make a difference with this disease, because it is not viewed as a disease by the public at large, and it's also acceptable to stigmatize those affected by it.
Aha. So now that we're a third of the population is in this category, is it time for us to try to take some action and get it recognized as a medical condition that needs the respect and the treatment that it deserves?
Well, okay, I have a two-part answer. The first part to that is that is exactly what the OAC is trying to do day in and day out. The second part is that by and large, most Americans do not realize how their weight is impacting their health, and they do not even realize if they are obese or overweight, even morbidly obese. If you ask someone on the street, do you think you are overweight or obese, they will tell you, I think I might be overweight. And then if they did their BMI, which again, we'll admit is not perfect, but if they did their BMI, you will find that they actually fall into the obese category. People do not realize, by and large, how their weight is affecting them, nor do they realize how much excess weight they actually have.
Right, and it's such a nasty term that a lot of people simply hate the term. And
there's truth to that too, yes.
Right. So, I mean, when somebody says you're obese, then of course you're going to reject that label. But I'm trying to figure out, I mean, for example, there's one guy who has been advertising himself as a speaker on radio shows, and his theme is the country can't afford these fat people. We really need to take them off of the healthcare rolls because they're just costing us too much. Now, that obviously is not a solution either, but it's just another way of bullying people. So we really need some recognition here that this is a medical condition. You didn't get into this condition overnight. You didn't do it, and most of us didn't do it on purpose. It kind of snuck up on us. And a lot of it is because of the manipulation of the food supply. The food supply, the advertising, the clean plate club in your house, all these kinds of things that we're surrounded with. And we need to somehow break through that and begin to change those attitudes that have led us here and that are raising this alarmingly.
Absolutely. Changing the attitude, changing the public perception, you know, it's very difficult. People don't like the word obesity. They definitely don't like the word morbidly obese, or the words morbidly obese, I should say. You know, but fat.
It makes it sound like you're dying, which is, you know, a possible consequence, but not a necessary consequence here. You need a term that's going to motivate people and not just, again, slam a label on their face that they hate.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Unfortunately, do we invest time and money into semantics, or do we invest time and money into a solution? And the growing rate of obesity, you know, we have to be looking more toward the solution. We tend to follow the CDC's guidelines. If the CDC came out tomorrow and said, okay, the appropriate medical term is fat for someone with a BMI between 30 and 39, you know, we're most likely, with board approval, we're most likely going to adopt that in our resources and in our stance.
Right. No, I agree with you. I mean, obviously, we need to work on the solutions and not the semantics. But somehow we need to motivate people, and I'm afraid the labels are counterproductive.
I would agree with that.
Here's one example. Lung cancer. If you come down with lung cancer, almost immediately the first question is, how long did you smoke? But women who have never smoked die of lung cancer in greater numbers than women who die of breast cancer and heart disease combined. So it's things like that. You know, how do we break through the stigma of lung cancer equals you did it to yourself?
I think, really, get down
to the problem.
I've been pinned against that question a couple times. I've taken a lot of heat on it, comparing cancer to obesity. And, you know, what I always say, and it seems to always get cut out in an interview, when I say lung cancer and, you know, if you, whether or not you quote-unquote did it to yourself, it's more if we're talking about lung cancer in regards to an individual that smokes. An individual that smokes and develops lung cancer, we do not tell them that there's no access to treatment. An individual that is an alcoholic and develops liver disease, we do not tell them there's no access to treatment. We provide treatment for these individuals. So how is it any different than an individual that becomes morbidly obese when they want to receive access to treatment? They pretty much hit a brick wall, and there's nothing for them to have, nothing for them to do, nowhere for them to turn. How is that fair? You know, and that's more or less what we try to get across, is that insurance companies, both public and private, do not have a problem covering options for individuals that have these diseases, whether or not they're self-inflicted. Yet when it comes to obesity and morbid obesity, then there's an issue.
Yeah. Yes. Good. No, I'm not going to cut that out. Well said, thank you. No, you're absolutely right. And that is the turn that we need to make. So people who agree with this stance really need to help change that attitude in society, that being overweight is a medical problem. You need to work with your doctor. You need to get going on it yourself. But also somehow we have to take the stigmatizing and the bullying out of what we're doing to our children, what we're doing to our colleagues at work, what we're doing on the television and in the media. Being overweight does not mean that you're stupid or sloppy or blah, 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 all the things that usually get attached to that. It means that there's an issue here that needs to be addressed.
Absolutely.
Great. Any other words that you'd like to leave with our audience before we go?
No, you know what? Maybe just a shameless plug to visit our website,
sure,
and look at our materials. And, you know, if anyone has any questions or comments, please feel free to contact me. And, you know, we definitely always love feedback. So, you know, we're a coalition of individuals affected by obesity. So we want to hear from anyone out there that thinks we could be doing things differently, doing things better. You know, we want to constantly improve ourselves. So I thank you for having me on today and giving me the opportunity to discuss some of these topics. I hope I was helpful in some of them, and if you all ever need any other information, to please feel free to contact me again.
Perfect. Thank you so much, James. And again, it's obesityaction.org, and there is very good information there and guidance on sources of help, places that you can go to get assistance with weight loss, and some advocacy hints and ways that you might be able to help in your own state or in the media to try to make that attitudinal shift that would be more constructive for those of us facing this problem. So thank you very, very much, James, and thank you, everybody, for being with us. And I hope you'll be with us again next week. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Thanks so much.
Thank you.